Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this Thanksgiving with an exploration into the megatrends that will impact our lives and the planet as we gather to celebrate that which we have to give thanks for. The author of The Eight Laws of Change, Stephen Schwartz, the editor of the daily web publication theschwartzreport.net, which concentrates on trends that will shape the future, joins us to discuss his new book, Awakening, and how simply being born white or male will no longer confer privilege in the future, and how a new form of global feudalism is evolving with a handful of plutocratic families controlling most of the world's wealth, while a vast worldwide peasantry scrambles to make a living as competition bids down labor and technological advances make traditional work obsolete. We will also explore hopeful trends as a growing mass movement develops as citizens around the world begin to realize that what they have in common and how they are all in lifeboat Earth together, which is threatened by rising sea levels from global warming, presenting a global challenge that transcends national boundaries. Then we will continue the conversation on Thanksgiving with Frank Schaefer, a best-selling author whose parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-renowned evangelical speakers and authors. And Frank previously worked for such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Focus on the Family's James Dobson. However, he felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead to his departure from the evangelical movement. The author of a number of fiction and non-fiction books, he joins us to discuss his latest iBook, Letter to Lucy, a manifesto of creative redemption in an age of Trump, fascism, and lies. And we'll also talk about the values of the non-commercial family holiday Thanksgiving. We'll also talk about how the values of the non-commercial family holiday Thanksgiving can be built upon to rescue the country from the Trump nightmare. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And on this Thanksgiving, we're joined by Stephen Schwartz, the editor of the daily web publication, theschwartzreport.net, which concentrates on trends that will shape the future, an area of research he has been working on since the mid-1960s. Previously, he was a senior Samueli Fellow in Brain, Mind, and Healing at the Samueli Institute. And his latest book is The Eight Laws of Change, and his forthcoming new book, a novel, is Awakening. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Schwartz.
Hello, Ian. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Well, happy Thanksgiving to you. And of course, this is my favorite holiday. It's the only holiday that hasn't been commercialized yet.
Me too.
And you also get a good meal out of it. And
that's it.
And a bunch of relatives, maybe the crazy uncle or two. But just, I know it sounds facile, but you know, yesterday I talked about the new nuclear industrial complex, and we're going to waste trillions of dollars on a whole new generation of nuclear weapons. And there's nothing more absurd than the idea that this country devotes its treasure to building things that can never be used and can only be used in the end of the world, in an Armageddon. There's no more indictment of our priorities of death over our priorities of life. So that was yesterday. What can you tell us today to cheer us up and be thankful about?
Well, I think there are a number of there are some good things. I agree with you. The trends are not happy generally, but there are some good things. There is, for instance, a really serious commitment in Europe and in Asia. I've just returned from China, and where I was, that was quite an eye-opening trip. But in any case, both in Europe, Norway, Denmark, France, Holland, and China, they are committed to ending petroleum vehicles, petroleum-powered vehicles, by about 2040. So that's not very far into the future. I think it's quite interesting that both Ford and Volkswagen have made huge investments, joint ventures with the Chinese in order to produce electric vehicles. I mean, it's very sad that the United States is going in directly the opposite direction and trying to do all it can to support carbon energy. But on the whole, I would say worldwide, there is a growing awareness of the implications of climate change for civilization and a commitment to to begin to do remediation so that the worst of this may not be visited upon us. So I think that's a good Thanksgiving Day thing to think about. I think we're beginning to see an increasing awareness of gender equality, all this stuff that's going on now that brought on by the Weinstein and now the Roy Moore business. I think finally we're beginning to understand as a culture and to hold the collective intention that men no longer get the right to molest women when they are in power and the women are seeking something. So, I can see some good things that are coming along, and as well as the negative things. So I think Thanksgiving is always a good time to take stock.
Well, since you were just in China, and apparently they're making a massive effort to get off coal and go solar, and the reverse is happening with the Trump administration, and of course they insulted the world by sending a delegation of coal executives to the climate conference, which the U.S. pulled out of, and they made absolute fools of themselves.
Yes, they did.
So what did you see in China that makes you think that they're on the right track, and will they end up cleaning our clock?
Yes, I think they're going to clean our clock big time. My guess is, based on the present day calculation, that China will be the dominant culture in the last half of the 21st century. The Chinese one of the reasons I wanted to go to China was that I had begun reading about in the English language press in Hong Kong and Asia Times, things like that, that the Chinese are committed to something called the ecological civilization. And I wanted to know what that meant. So I was invited by the Chinese, and with the government's involvement in some way I never fully understood, anyway, come over there and do a presentation on my Eight Laws of Change book. And I had an opportunity to speak with a number of Chinese officials at a very senior level, and asking them, what is the ecological civilization? And the best explanation I got was one night after dinner. I was speaking with a Chinese, I think a minister. It's a little hard to it was a little difficult for me to pin down exactly because I don't know the government as well as perhaps I should. But in any case, a senior man, asked him that question, and he said to me, well, you know, we tried coal, and it was a disaster. The health costs as a result of the bad air that resulted from massive consumption of coal and all that, we realized that that just was not the way to go. And it left me with the realization that the United States is governed by politicians, most of whom now are really basically involved with power and greed. China is it's not the system that I would want to live under, but China is basically run by engineers who are pragmatic. The other thing is, which I thought was very significant, is that the Chinese have eliminated religion as a consideration in politics. Something that the founders of the United States also tried to do to create a firewall. We have breached that firewall very badly now. But in China, they really just don't have religion as a factor. And so they look at everything very pragmatically. And they recognize that the only way that we're going to get through what's coming with climate change is, as I say, is to create what they call the ecological civilization. And so I said to him, well, you know, what does that mean? And he said, well, one of the things it means is that we need to get petroleum vehicles off the roadways. The other is they're building what they call the New Silk Road, which is an extraordinarily sophisticated high-speed rail system that's going to go across China and all the way to Europe. And they're building what they call the Maritime Silk Road, which is going to be a series of ports and a whole shipping system The thing you come away with when you talk with the Chinese is that we think in terms of quarters. They think in terms of decades or maybe even multi-decades. I mean, the things that were described to me were things that were going to happen over the next 50 to 100 years. You never hear American politicians talk about something that we're going to be doing 50 years from now. So my takeaway was that they get ecology not as a philosophical position so much as a pragmatic engineering position. And because it's a centrally controlled government, there is a deep commitment that they want to do what is practical and most efficient. The other two things that really I came away with was, in all the weeks I was in China, I never saw a single fat person. I mean, you think for a minute, well, that's sort of an odd thing to note, but if you know, as I came home, as I was standing in the airport in Seattle, I mean, I noticed that about 50% of the people were either overweight or morbidly obese. And in all those weeks in China, I never saw a single fat person. The other thing is, I never saw a single clunker car on the road. When I was last there in 89, most of the vehicles that you saw were these kind of strange socialist aesthetic things, and lots of bicycles, of course. Now you see very high-end cars. I was in Shanghai mostly, and I saw more Ferraris and Maseratis than I have ever seen in, for instance, Seattle. So there's clearly a great deal of money. No one discusses politics, so that's something that I would not be comfortable with. But in any case, what you do get is a wealthy country that is deeply committed to long-term planning, whereas in the United States, it all seems very ad hoc to me and mostly based on creating profit in the short term for a very small group of people.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Schwartz, who's the editor of the daily web publication, theschwartzreport.net, which concentrates on trends that will shape the future, an area of research he's been working on since the mid-1960s. Previously, he was the senior Samueli Fellow in Brain, Mind, and Healing at the Samueli Institute, and he's the author of The Eight Laws of Change, and his latest book out soon is a novel, Awakening. So again, on Thanksgiving, we really... We certainly don't have anything to be thankful for in terms of our political leadership or the lack thereof, particularly in the context of what you've been telling us from what's happening in China. Not that we would envy their political system. And clearly, ever since the Tiananmen Square massacre, the students who had aspirations for democracy and built that statue in an homage to democracy, the Chinese regime since then has encourage nationalism and materialism. And to that extent, what's your sense of whether or not the totalitarian or authoritarian part of the system will survive? If their long-term planning with these engineers into 50 years hence, obviously the difference between what Gorbachev did in Russia, which was he used glasnost in order to inspire perestroika, well, that backfired the minute he allowed people to speak freely. The emperor had no clothes. But the Chinese have done the opposite. They've allowed perestroika, but no glasnost. That can't continue forever, surely.
Well, I think you're probably correct, Ian. The thing that I come away with, as you know, I was in Russia for much of, in fact, virtually all of the glasnost perestroika period. You know, I was when they detained Gorbachev, and Yeltsin was standing on the tank and all that. I was in the Ukraine hotel, looking at it. So I had a lot of experience in the former Soviet Union, and one of the reasons that I was very keen to go to China was to compare this transitional issue that of glasnost perestroika with what's going on in China, where they're clearly undergoing massive change. My takeaway from it was that nations are the character of nations arises from collective intention of millions of people. and that the characteristics of the culture tend to revert or tend to become predominant again in periods of transition. I mean, from my perspective, Russia has reverted to the czarist system. They have a kind of czarist oligarchy. And China has reverted to the Mandarin system. I mean, they don't call them Mandarins anymore. They call them members of the Communist Party. But there's nothing communist about it in the sense that Marx or Lenin would have been comfortable with. What you have instead is a huge country, you know, it's the most populous nation in the world, and they've got... So that really makes a difference when you're thinking about how do you manage, you know, 1.5 billion people, that they have created a system where they don't tolerate and are very frightened of anything which creates social disorder, because social disorder in a country with that large a population causes enormous problems. So they're very sensitive about anything that creates social disorder. Doesn't matter what it is. But at the same time, they are clearly, as you could see from the fact that there were no clunker cars on the road, there is a very affluent culture that's developing in China. I mean, I was very struck by the teenagers. I pay attention to little things. And if you look at the teenagers, particularly their shoes and their clothes, what you see is kids who would be perfectly at home in L.A. down on Hollywood Boulevard. I mean, they had all the latest whatever it was. They had all the latest look. Everybody's carrying very expensive smartphones. There clearly is a rising affluence, and there is I saw almost no sort of traditional Asian clothing. The entire time that I was there, I only had one beggar come up to me and panhandle me, whereas, I mean, if you were in New York, you'd get 20 people by the time you got to the end of the street. So I was struck by the affluence. I was struck also, again, and I've noticed this before when I've been in Japan and other parts of Asia, but particularly in China, for some reason, it really hit me. And that is that it is a we culture, while we are an I culture. And I think part of it arises from the fact, I mean, this may seem odd, but it really struck me, is that everybody has the same color hair and the same color eyes. And so it's all sort of one big tribe. Now, China has got very strong racial groups, I mean, very distinct, the Han and all the Mongols and... But nonetheless, everybody's got the same color hair and the same color eyes, basically. And it tends to create a kind of we-ness, if you see what I'm trying to say. So there is this sort of collective intention that's present in the culture in a way that we in the United States, who are undergoing what I think of as the Great Schism trend, where we have become so tribal. I mean, you look at Alabama. I see this Alabama election as basically the people of Alabama defining themselves. Do they care more about actual personal morality, or do they care more about the articulation of values? Are they consumed by a kind of Christo-fascist Christianity, or are they going to be a forward, progressive-looking culture? And in China, what I got was that there is this sort of enthusiasm for what's happening in China. I didn't hear anybody complaining. I saw an awful lot of people who seemed to be not only happy with what was happening in their lives, but sort of very energetic about it in a way that you used to see in the United States in the 50s or the 60s, but you don't see much anymore. I didn't see the kind of, I don't know what to call it, malaise that you hear in any conversation with a group of Americans now who were, you know, who were either for Trump or just utterly appalled at what's happening.
Well, but there is another side to it, in as much as the children of the elite and the elite themselves are sending their kids abroad for education. American universities are full of these rich young Chinese kids, and they're all buying expensive condos and apartments, which are largely empty. And as we learn from Jared Kushner's sister, you can sell condos and a green card at the same time. So it's as though the princelings have an escape hatch along with the wealthy Chinese. So they're not exactly confident, it would seem, about the country's future, about their ability to hold on to their money, whether it's, you know, ill-gotten gains or not.
Yes, I think you see that not only with the Chinese, but the Russians. Well, I mean, if you think about it, you know, the United States, there has been no warfare on our soil since the 1860s. I mean, I suppose a brief Japanese incursion in the Aleutian Islands. Most people don't even know where they are. So in the United States, we have not had civil conflict, I mean, really open war, since the 1860s. So nobody alive has any direct experience with that, whereas with the Chinese, you know, they lost 35 million people during the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution during the Second War. You look at the Russians and how many people died during the Stalin period. I mean, they have these deep, enculturated memories of what civil conflict is like, whereas Americans, we not only don't have any memory of civil conflict on our soil, but only about 1% of our population are even involved with the military. So we live in a kind of bubble. And I think it is perfectly true to say that the those who of means in both China and Russia who have the ability to do so always create an escape hatch because, well, you never know. Grandfather, you know, my grandfather was a wealthy merchant, and he ended up in a prison camp. So that's a direct memory that people in China and Russia have. You know, you go to Leningrad or St. Petersburg, and you talk to people who are, when I was going over there very regularly in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s, you know, you'd have dinner with somebody and they would start talking about their experience or their grandmother's experience or their mother's experience during the siege of the city, which went on, and millions, you know, suffered as a result. So this direct memory of civil strife is a huge cultural factor that we just don't have in this country.
Well, but just in terms of the income inequality in China, it's as bad, if not worse, than the income inequality here in the United States. And we've just seen from this obscenity with the Republican so-called tax reform how what whores they are for the wealthy, these Congress people, these Republicans, are just despicable in such fealty to the donor class and stealing from the poor to give to the rich. And one of the groups that they went after, believe it or not, are grad students. You know, the one thing the U.S. needs is a bunch of PhDs, and now they're quadrupling their taxes. The whole thing is insane. But I don't want to digress. I want to get your, just in the last couple of minutes here, get your opinion on the relative, the comparison between the growing inequality in China and here in the United States, and in a global context, you know, as though we're creating a kind of new form of global elite.
Well, I think you are very accurately describing one of the four major megatrends that are shaping the culture that nobody talks about. I mean, there are four major, in my view, there are four major megatrends that are taking place all over the world that are shaping not only the United States, but all the countries in the world. The first is being born white will no longer confer privilege. Second, being born male will no longer bestow dominance. Third, Western European and North American culture values will no longer be the only determinant of how the world operates. And fourth, and directly addressing this point you've just made, the transfer of real power from nation states to what amount to virtual corporate states, and the rise of neo-feudalism. That's something, I mean, you know, Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, and Jeff Bezos apparently have as much wealth as the 50% of the American population. So you see the same kind of thing going on in China, and you see it going on in Europe. We have the rise of a world oligarchy, in which a very tiny group of people control most of the wealth of the world. You have a small middle class, mostly made up of people of professional skills, doctors, lawyers, accountants, engineers. And then you have a vast peasantry, not of land as in the medieval period, but a peasantry of wage serfs who basically control almost nothing, have almost no wealth compared to the uber rich. And this is, I think, a huge crisis that's going on all over the world. And you can, in the United States, it's become particularly egregious because Citizens United legalized bribery. I mean, basically, five conservative justices sold the American system to corporations. And you can see it played out almost daily. I mean, you look at the correlation between who makes donations in the pharmaceutical area and how they vote, just as an example, or in the agricultural area and how they vote. And you see that legalized bribery has become the norm in the United States, and its effect on democracy is disastrous.
Well, Stephen Schwartz, you've given us a lot to think about on this Thanksgiving, not necessarily to be thankful for, but to think about, and I thank you for joining us.
Take care.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Schwartz, who's the editor of the daily web publication, theschwartzreport.net, which concentrates on trends that will shape the future, an area of research he's been working on since the mid-1960s. Previously, he's been a senior Samueli Fellow in Brain, Mind, and Healing at the Samueli Institute, and he's the author of The Eight Laws of Change. And his latest book out soon is a novel, Awakening. Let's take a brief station break. We're back continuing the conversation about how the values of the non-commercial family holiday Thanksgiving can be built upon to rescue the country from the Trump nightmare. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us on this Thanksgiving is Frank Schaefer, who is a best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors, and he previously worked with such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Focus on the Family's James Dobson. Frank Schaefer, however, felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead to his departure from the evangelical movement. His novels include Portofino and Saving Grandma, and his nonfiction books include Crazy for God, Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism, Sex, Mom, and God, and his latest is an iBook, Letter to Lucy, a Manifesto of Creative Redemption in the Age of Trump, Fascism, and Lies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frank Schaefer.
Hey, always good to talk to you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Frank, and tell me about your latest book. Who is Lucy, and what are you trying to achieve with this book? Because it sounds like more than a book, it sounds like a kind of political movement.
Yeah, the thing is, there's two Lucys in the book. One is my granddaughter, who's now 9 years old, and when I started writing this was four. And the other is Lucy, who is the skeletal remains of someone that, you know, non-scientists call the mother of the human race, found in the African Rift Valley, bone fragments, the first, you know, complete skeleton of an identifiable female Homo sapiens. So I'm kind of writing a letter to her saying, look, this is how we've screwed this up, and here's how I would fix it. And I'm writing to my granddaughter saying, look, this is what I'd like to pass on to you of value. Here's how we rebuild a civilization that has been trashed by the religious right that I played a part in. So it's part memoir. It is part, I would say, manifesto. The creative redemption comes in very strongly in that I track my view of the arts, contemporary art, art history, art in the life of children. I talk about my three grandchildren that I do daycare for, currently ages 3, 7, and 9, Lucy being the oldest, what I do with them, why there are art books lying around the house, why they are not staring at screens all day, and all the rest of it. So essentially, my sense of our present moment of history as we look at Donald Trump and what the religious right has done is that we've really had a kind of a national lobotomy. It isn't just political mistakes that have been made. It's educational, cultural mistakes that have been made. There's no use whining and wringing our hands about the stupidity of the religious right on one hand. And on the other hand, something on the what you would consider the secular side, the sort of con artists who are running the large monopolies in the art business today, whether it's the huge auction houses or the billionaires buying the art that then donate to museums of contemporary art in order to have it validated, and a kind of a circular way that this corruption has come into art and taken out of the area of creativity and just simply made it another big business. You know, when you look at all this, you understand that more needs to be done in our culture than simply voting for Democrats. Now, I also happen to be running around the country right now doing videos with Democratic candidates for Congress, fighting to help them take back the House in 2018. And that comes into it as well. And the only other thing I'd add about Letter to Lucy before you ask me more questions is that unlike my other books that always were in print first with Penguin and Macmillan and all these other houses that have published my 14 books over the years, this time we went to iBooks first, and then in about 6 weeks it'll be on Kindle, because on iBooks, they have the technology for the last year to allow me to not simply give links to the art and the music and the film and the television and the performances I'm talking about, but actually embed them. So when people download the book onto their iPad or their Apple laptop or iPhone or whatever it may be, they actually have the art. It isn't like, well, you should go to the museum and see this, or here's a link to something on YouTube. It is in the text, so that the book is laid out like a really good copy of, say, Italian Vogue 10 years ago when they were making design history, or, you know, the great Richard Avedon-type spreads in places like Vanity Fair. It is a serious book. It's 400 pages long, but it's got so much art, so much music, so much film, so much interactive capability. For instance, just an example, Peter Bruegel the Elder has these great paintings of his, these Flemish paintings that my grandchildren love because they have people's naked bottoms sticking out of windows pooping into a river. Well, my wonderful design partner, EJ, who I've partnered with on this book for the design function, has it so if you touch the screen, you zero in on exactly what I was talking about. You don't have to search it. And this carries all the way through the book. So in the first chapter, there's a Green Day video where they're protesting Donald Trump's election. In the same chapter, there's two beautiful pieces of music by Vivaldi, who ties in with that chapter because his music was lost at a period of cultural decline. And the very fact that his music was rediscovered in the 19th century and revived is an amazingly encouraging thing. So Letter to Lucy is really a book about redemptive actions through history by individuals who say, hell no, you know, we're not going to be Nazis for the rest of time. We're going to have a denazification program and change our country. Hell no, we're not going to be a racist country forever. We're not going to keep lynching black men. We're going to have a Voting Rights Act. Hell no, we're not going to be treating women like servile chattel property forever. We're going to encourage the feminist movement. And a lot of this has come from art and culture, and I track that through the book while talking about what I'm doing with my grandchildren, literally day by day, the choices we're making, whether it's cooking together or playing outside or looking at art or going to a museum or a concert and so forth. So it's a very practical, guide to, if I can be so bold, sanity in a very insane moment of history. And of course, you know, I'm right up in Donald Trump's face and take him on head to head as a member of, as a former member of the religious right that feels terribly guilty about having created the framework out of which so much of the present climate of intolerance has come, and begging people to really look at what's best in our cultural history and try to revive that and build from it.
So here we are on Thanksgiving, searching around for something to be thankful for when we have a kleptocratic family in charge of the United States in league with all kinds of despots around the world. And not only has America being diminished, its standing and respect around the world is being diminished because Trump is more comfortable with despots like the Chinese leader, Putin, Duterte, and Erdogan. And at home, we have a kind of litmus test on December the 12th in Alabama. There will be an election for the U.S. Senate where a religious right figure, Roy Moore, who is a child molester and a pedophile, is likely to be elected over a very decent Democrat who brought about final justice against the Ku Klux Klan for the bombing of the Birmingham church in 1963. So I don't think we could have a more stark moment here in America. Let's turn to that race down in Alabama and the notion that people in the Republican Party would rather vote for a pedophile and a child molester than a Democrat.
You know, it's interesting that you just in your litany of mentioning the people that he feels comfortable with, which do not include the leader of the great world democracies, but all these tinpot dictators and authoritarian figures or outright mass murderers like Putin. You know, you mentioned Erdogan, and isn't it amazing you and I are talking here on Thanksgiving, and just last week, Turkey announced a complete ban on all activities by gay people in Turkey. No parties, no speeches, no talks, no publications, no public events, no school teaching, no university events. How striking is that? Because Trump loves Erdogan, and he's an authoritarian like him, but also the agenda of the religious right I come out of, the election of Roy Moore, his platform of being anti-gay, the Reconstructionist Christian movement that believes that we should go back to Old Testament law, prosecute gays, perhaps kill them, that is fully supported, by the way, by Mike Pence, who has been a leader in the political wing of that movement. It all comes to a point here, doesn't it, Ian? I mean, you're looking at a worldwide rise of right-wing, fascist, often religiously intolerant movements, whether it is extremist Islam, extremist American Christianity of the kind that supports Roy Moore, where 40% of the people in Alabama say, yes, we would rather vote for a pedophile than for a Democrat, even if he did it. So, you know, that's our moment. This is the moment in time we're living in. And the issue that I'm trying to address here today in this interview and also in my recent book is we've got to take a step back and a deep breath. There's two priorities as far as I'm concerned. One is the short term. The Democrats have to win back the House in 2018, which is why I am touring the country. And if people go to my blog, frankschaferblog.com, they will find a whole series, I've posted six so far, of interviews with progressive Democratic candidates who are going head-to-head or hope soon to go head-to-head with incumbent Republicans. One of them is Randy Brice in Wisconsin, who is taking on Paul Ryan, who, as we all know, has been a lickspittle, a shell of Donald Trump, a gutless wonder, as Winston Churchill would have called him. And so, you know, I'm getting involved on that level, and I think we all need to. I'm not saying everybody needs to go off and shoot videos on their own nickel the way I am and run around putting them on Facebook to introduce people to what I hope will be the new face of a triumphant Democratic Party. But we all need to do something. Donate money, volunteer, vote as never before. But we also need to be looking at the long term, which is what Letter to Lucy, a manifesto of creative redemption for the age of Trump fascism and lies is about. There's no use continuing down this path. We have to understand that if our children are all staring at screens and losing a tactile relationship with beauty, if our education is simply to prepare for global economic competition and not about the transcendent value of learning, if we don't have relationships in our lives that we're putting ahead of material gain, then in our own way, we are all simply feeding into this glitzy, gold-plated, bullshit crap world that Trump loves of personal ego and fulfillment only seen in material terms. And so my plea with my readers in Letter to Lucy is, yes, stand, resist, be political to the hilt, as I am doing myself, but at the same time, let's seriously look at what not only makes life worth living, but at those moments in civilization, which, for instance, in the latter part of the Renaissance, or the high point of the Enlightenment, or some of the writings of our founding fathers and so forth, actually points us in directions toward tolerance. So, for instance, just take one issue, Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci's homosexuality. Renaissance Italian families like the Medici supported and defended them against the church. And, you know, when Leonardo was arrested once for a homosexual act, he was fortunate enough to be arrested along with one of the Medici family people. And so they were all let go. And the Medicis would make sure that he was protected as an artist. And they made sure that Michelangelo was able to paint his humanistic and sculpt his humanistic statues, and before him Botticelli with the Primavera, the Birth of Venus, and so forth, which were frowned on by the church. But the Medici got between them and the intolerance of people until Savonarola came along and started burning art. Americans don't want to know about history or art or culture these days. It's all on Twitter. It's this, that, and the other. And, of course, that's a generalization. And I'm saying, wait. If you don't like the world we're in, it's because we have entertained ourselves to death with, excuse the language here, crap. Just bold-faced, wall-to-wall crap. And unless we start with children and ourselves for the spiritual good of our own souls to demand something more, not just from this gold-plated fool Trump, who is more like some demented Saudi prince cavorting around our country than an American president, you know, if we don't like this picture, you know, this entertainer, this fraud, this grifter in charge of our country, the reason he is there is because a significant portion of our people have completely lost touch with what I will call the parts of life that actually make it worthwhile. And I'm not talking about money. I'm not talking about elite educations. I am talking about that human connection, which I would sum up as the intrinsic worth of beauty. Being inarguable. That's more important than getting a degree that helps you start a startup in Silicon Valley. The intrinsic worth of beauty. So I'm arguing for that in a longer term, but I'm also in the short term telling people to donate, vote, and so forth.
Let's just take a brief station break and we'll be back resuming the conversation on this Thanksgiving with Frank Schaefer. Baby, why don't you give me brand new style? So let me live. So let me live. Let me live. Leave me alone. Let me live. Oh, baby. Make a brand new start. Why don't you take another little piece of my soul? Why don't you shape it? Shake it. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And we are resuming the conversation with Frank Schaefer, who's a best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors, and he previously worked with such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Focus on the Family's James Dobson. However, he felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead to his departure from the evangelical movement. And his novels are Portofino and Saving Grace are among many. And of course, his latest book is Letter to Lucy, A Manifesto of Creative Redemption in an Age of Trump, Fascism, and Lies. Now, it's wonderful that you're out there in Wisconsin with the steel worker running against
Randy Bright,
running against Paul Ryan, who's got his pickup truck with his gun rack. And I've always thought that the Democrats lost the last election largely because they don't talk to the white working class, and we've always needed sort of macho liberals in this country, which is sort of so much falls prey to the right, even though when people like Bernie Sanders go out there and speak, people realize, my God, I agree with everything he's saying. So it's very hard to navigate this political landscape and win back people that used to be a part of the Democratic Party coalition. And I think one of the main problems we have is the Fox News bubble with Sean Hannity and company purveying this distorted news, fake news, while accusing the rest of the media of having fake news. That seems to be the glue of the movement that is holding Trump in power.
Yeah, it is. It is, but it's the superficial glue, because I want to get back to what I was saying before. You know, I remember a few years ago you brought me out to the Hammer Museum at UCLA as a venue for me to talk about one of my books that was new then. I think it was Patience with God. And what was interesting to me was that the venue, being an art museum, was actually a place that the discussion belongs. Because the truth of the matter is, if you look back, for instance, into the history of evangelicalism in America, it was evangelicals that fought for public education. It was evangelicals that fought for women's rights. It was evangelicals that fought to end child labor laws. What we now have...
And slavery, by the way.
And slavery before that. Now, there's always been a bigoted southern wing, you know, that was out there with lynch mobs and a pastor blessing the lynching of some black men. Yes, that was going on. But the other side of the evangelical movement in America was the strong social justice movement that has been denied now by the Trumped white voting bloc that comes out of not just Fox News, but Jerry Falwell Jr., for instance, the son of Jerry Falwell Sr., who I spoke for at his university when I was a right-wing shill myself. So when you see this reversal, this denial of the social history of evangelical involvement in American life, from a secular point of view, people, I'm afraid, make this mistake of saying, oh, well, these evangelicals have always been this way. We don't agree with the theology. They've got crazy ideas about women and gays and so forth. They dismiss the whole movement. That's sad, actually, because within the evangelical movement itself is a truth to call people back to. So it's not just a question of Randy Bryce talking to fellow steel workers and people, and I like Randy a lot. I spent a day with him. I think he's got a great message. It's also a message that people who are progressive, such as myself and yourself, have to put out there in terms of calling back evangelicals to their better angels, to their better selves. I'll give you one example that's not ancient history. It happened in my lifetime. You know, in the 1950s, Billy Graham was the first big-time white, you might call him entertainer of his level, or preacher or anyone else, to insist on desegregating his rallies. He would no longer preach after 1954, which is pretty early in the movement, at a segregated Christian rally. That was a stand. Billy Graham told me personally, back in the 1970s, when my dad, Francis Schaeffer, and I sat down with him at the Mayo Clinic, where Dad was undergoing cancer treatment and I was visiting my father, we were trying to argue him into taking an anti-abortion position. He said, that is a Catholic issue. We evangelicals believe in giving women freedom and forgiving people for their mistakes. He would not get involved. Now look at his son. Franklin Graham is a hate monger. Not only does he come down on the side of the anti-abortion movement, he also comes down on the side of people like Hobby Lobby, who have just opened the Museum of the Bible in LA, in Washington, D.C., by the way, when it comes to them suing in the Supreme Court and winning a suit that allows them to deny insurance contraceptive coverage to their women. Billy Graham was pro-choice. Dr. Criswell, who was the head of the Southern Baptist Convention and was the pastor of First Baptist in Dallas, the heartbeat of the Southern Baptist movement, would not join the pro-life anti-abortion movement. He said, I've always been on the side of women and pro-choice. Babies are not the same as grown-up people. You can't tell me a fetus is a full person. That was in the heartland of evangelicalism in the 70s. So one of the stories that has been lost here that I talk about in the first chapters of Letter to Lucy is the mistake that people like Hillary Clinton made in just blasting by the evangelicals as the enemy and not realizing that even in the short-term history, it could be appealed to. Hey, just a week ago, I was on with Joy Reid again on MSNBC on her show, and Joy was asking me about some of this, and I brought up an example with Roy Moore in terms of just saying how things had changed. I remember Billy Graham and my dad over tea when I was a young kid around, I think I was 12 or 13, talking at some length about how disappointed Billy Graham was with Nixon in Watergate. No, I was a little older than 13. Anyway, my math on dates is bad. But anyway, I was a kid. I was in my teens, and Watergate was taking place. And I can remember Billy telling Dad, I'll never back a candidate for office again. I thought Nixon was a born-again Christian, and so I backed him. Listen, I've listened to the Watergate tapes when they were released, and his profanity, his anti-Semitism, he was drinking. Now think of that level of shock. And now we have evangelicals defending Roy Moore, accused of pedophilia.
Wait a minute.
Just a generation ago, Billy Graham was shocked because someone was an anti-Semite. Now, evangelicals, including his own son, defend candidates like Roy Moore. How things have changed. That's what we have to call people back to.
Right, but I was interjecting to point out that Republicans and a lot of Americans, not enough, 3 million fewer, voted for Donald Trump after the Access Hollywood tapes where he says on camera how he can kiss women without their permission and grab them by the private parts. So something has happened in terms of the lack of a kind of ethical foundation and a moral stand right across the board. And of course, you know, all kinds of men are being hauled forth over sexual harassment. And I think at the end of the day, hopefully there will be a change in the culture. But I don't think there'll be any real change in this country unless Donald Trump is driven out of the White House. And my sense is that Mueller may well do that. I think the final recommendation of his investigation will be to impeach Donald Trump because he's close to Comey. Comey's seen this president up close and personal. He knows that he's a crook. He knows that his entire business model is money laundering criminal kleptocrats' money. And he is basically, perhaps even Comey himself is trying to expiate for his meddling in the elections at the last minute. But I have a sense that there still is some justice left in the world. And as we celebrate Thanksgiving, we shouldn't be paralyzed and overwhelmed by the mendacity of the Trump and his family capturing this country and taking it into the sewer, but rather feel some hope that justice will prevail.
I think it will, but I also think that we have to be very mindful of the fact that the climate in which Trump became president is, and I'm going to say this again, a climate in which we have devalued, whether it's evangelicals forgetting their history of social justice or the left forgetting to talk to people like Randy Bryce, who's now running as a Democrat against Paul Ryan in Wisconsin, forgetting to include people like that. We have become too besotted with our own navel gazing, whether it's an overabundance of identity politics, whether it's an overabundance of the kind of selfishness that we see in Silicon Valley, where technically a lot of these people would describe themselves as liberals, but it turns out in the way they manipulate information for their personal gain, crash privacy, and all the rest of it, they're really kind of just the new generation of 19th century railroad barons. We have to get real and admit who we are. And who we have become as an American people is often people bereft of spiritual content. Now, the good news on Thanksgiving is that there is a path back to that. And I know this is going to sound a bit Oprah-esque and idealistic, but it is the path that you find in movies. For instance, the old Christmas classic that will be coming up soon after Thanksgiving, It's a Wonderful Life. Right now, we're in a situation, if you want to make a parallel here, where if you remember the movie, George Bailey goes up against Potter, and Potter's this greedy, horrible banker, sort of this Trump-like figure, absolutely dreadful human being. George Bailey's trying to save ordinary people, loan them some money, let them buy a house, and so forth. It's a real parable for our time. And all I can say is when you look at the tax bill that the Republicans are voting in, where billionaires are given huge cuts and ordinary people have health care cut, student loan deductions cut, but you can deduct for expenses on your private jet. That's the world in which it is as if you reverse the movie. George Bailey jumps over the bridge. Potter wins, and we are all in Pottersville. The answer is the one that Frank Capra fought for. It's no coincidence that Capra made that movie right after he was finished making films for the U.S. government during the war, showing the evils of Nazism in his four-film series, What We Fight For. Then he came back and he made It's a Wonderful Life. That was his statement of the truth of what he thought the bottom of American democracy rested on, the foundation. It wasn't on just government programs or the Constitution. It was on ordinary men and women like George Bailey who had the good sense to put their neighbors first. It was on that type of value. And that is what we need to, in the Thanksgiving Christmas season, look back on. That is what I am trying to talk about in this book, Letter to Lucy. I'm not just talking in some romantic term of being nice to people because it's a hard-edged look. I think that the first three chapters, I ripped Donald Trump down in terms of his cultural position in world history in a way that perhaps is even better than some critiques you might have read so far. But then I build. And I don't build on some airy-fairy thing. I build in the same way Frank Capra tried to build, and that is I talk about genuine family values, where we really do value the lives of the people around us that we love, whether we're a gay couple or a straight couple or transgender, have children or don't have children. That's not the point. When I talk about family, I mean the human family.
Right.
So that is where we have to begin to put our emphasis again. What's wrong with the Republican tax bill is not that it doesn't make economic sense and there's no trickle-down that's going to reach anybody as people lose their health care. What's wrong with it is that it flies in the face of the basic prime directive of human existence, and that is consciousness and empathy. And when we lose that, the game's over. And we have lost that enough so that we have Trump as president. So yes, I think he will go down. And then it's up to all of us to start rebuilding. Let's just remember that all of this Trump era can end in a moment of light. And we do not have to settle for what we have now. It can be the door to a next better step.
Well, Frank Schaefer, I thank you very much for joining us on this Thanksgiving.
My pleasure.
And again, I'm speaking with Frank Schaefer, who's the best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors. He previously worked with such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and focused on the family's James Dobson. However, he felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead to his departure from the evangelical movement. He's written a number of novels and nonfiction books, the latest of which is Letter to Lucy, A Manifesto of Creative Redemption in an Age of Trump, Fascism, and Lies. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.